Welcome to the Denmark Street Deep Dive, a podcast designed to feed your enthusiasm for the world of Cormoran Strike and Robin Ellicott, creations of the fabulous J.K. Rowling, writing as Robert Galbraith. This time, I'm finally looking at the most recent novel in the series, Troubled Blood, the only one as yet unadapted for television, and which has recently come out in paperback, having garnered a number of literary accolades and nominations. It's a heavy tome, the longest yet, and the first time our protagonists have taken on a cold case. I haven't been able to fit in everything I wanted to in one episode, and I really feel like a deep dive into this one would require specialist breathing equipment, but I hope I have enough content here for you to really enjoy. I've decided to look quite closely at one of the aspects of the book which seems to have caused the biggest sense of dissatisfaction, the use of arcane and oblique occult divination methods. As ever, strong warning for spoilers. The deep dive is an exercise in really trying to dig into things you might not spot on a first reading. So, if you haven't completed the first reading yet, pause the podcast, fire up your Kindle or open your paperback, set up your audible narration, or hoist up your hardback copy with the muscles you'll need to hold it long enough to finish it, and then return to see if I can add anything to your enjoyment. I hope I can.
I didn't know people still did this.
It's a classic.
Troubled Blood is something of an epic book. Not only is it an ambitious premise, solving a decades-old murder case that the original investigation completely botched due to the mental health breakdown of the detective in charge, it covers some truly seismic shifts in the lives of Strike and Robin, and indeed weather events that still leave their scars on the UK today. We rejoin the detectives after the promising end of Lethal White, when their estrangement after Robin's doomed marriage had been resolved, and it looked very much like the trajectory of their friendship was beginning to look rosy. But Rowling's plots, like life, are rarely completely straightforward, and other factors have cast a little uncertainty over the romantic prospects for the pair. However, lest you should think the very idea of them together is ludicrous, Strike's thoughts and feelings for his partner are the very first beat of the book, setting up a Russian literature reference that will provide one of the book's most satisfying payoffs. But let me rein myself in. We're quickly introduced to the daughter of a woman who went missing nigh on 40 years before, and who, it was presumed, was a victim of the now-captured serial killer Dennis Creed. No trace of Margot Bamborough, GP and feminist and sometime bunny girl, was ever found, and her daughter Anna has spent the intervening years seeking answers from orthodox and unorthodox sources alike. Her chance meeting with Strike in Cornwall leads her to enlist his services. While not optimistic, Strike and Robin take the case, with a long lead time to give themselves a reasonable prospect of picking up a trail not only cold, but almost hopelessly contaminated. With this backdrop, the novel takes the time to show us more of Strike's family life, fleshing out his character with, at times, deeply moving interactions with his Aunt Joan and Uncle Ted, and his sister Lucy. He's also put on the spot in dramatic fashion by the increasingly erratic and destructive behaviour of his ex, Charlotte. Robin, too, is navigating the intensely stressful and emotional waters of a divorce, becoming an aunt herself, and the frustrations of being a woman in a world that seems set up to knock her down. Her personal sense of connection to Margot as the book progresses and the parallels of their lives, though separated by many years, are some of the most deeply effective parts of the story. There is so much in this book. The personal and emotional breakthroughs for Strike and Robin, the main case and the minor cases the agency takes on, the new employees of the agency and the shift in dynamic they bring, a dozen stinky red herrings, showdowns with serial killers, and the almost incomprehensible ramblings of a man whose thyroid condition masked his decent copper's instinct. There are some who think the book could have benefited from a bit of a trim, And while I do see the point, I wouldn't know what to drop, because I honestly think it all weaves deftly into the things I think Rowling is trying to do.
No, it's good.
The murder plot hinges significantly on the use of esoteric divination tools like astrology and tarot. D.I. Talbot, the original investigating officer, descended into seeming incoherence in his case notes, relying heavily on versions of astrology and tarot that would have been obscure even to practitioners of those arts who were familiar with them. Talbot's astrological system was a mix of the popular one still in use today, the one that will give you your horoscope in the newspaper or magazine, and the work of a minor figure in astrology, Stephen Schmidt, whose work in 1970 posited an extra two astrological signs. This melding of two systems creates enough confusion to sidetrack our detectives and obscure the genuine clues hidden in the case notes by the layers of esoteric obfuscation. It's hard to decode a message if you don't have the right key to begin with, and it's almost impossible if you start with the presumption that it's a meaningless jumble of insane nonsense, which is where the two themes of the book weave into this aspect of the case, that of chance and bias. I've pointed out elsewhere that there is enough in the book for Strike and Robin to have solved the case once they knew about the Schmidt variant astrology, because in the admittedly bizarre vocabulary of Talbot's notes, he is pointing very strongly to the killer's identity and the thought process that led him to his conclusion. But because of Strike's bias against superstitious belief systems and, to some extent, religion in general, he rather oddly, to my mind, doesn't employ his usual rigorous examination of the evidence. It's as though he feels that to even accept that there might be some sense in the notebook is to give credence to the objective reality of the beliefs that the notebook references. Now, this really doesn't follow logically, but it is a good example of Strike having a flaw which makes him interesting. It's also not entirely consistent. In Lethal White, for example, when white horses abound during the investigation, Strike remarks that it was beginning to get stupid, talks about white horses as omens, and it's Robin who reminds him of coincidence, and that the white horse is simply a very common pub name. The root of Strike's bias against this sort of thing is most likely explained by his mother's keen interest in it, and possibly due to his exposure to the wackier end of these beliefs in his time in the commune, which we have yet to hear any details of. In one of the funniest exchanges of the book on Strike's birthday, he reveals that not only does he know his star sign, but he's well versed in his entire natal chart. Personally, I can't help wondering if a younger Strike wasn't at all sceptical about these beliefs, and that his bias against them arises from a strong reaction that changed his mind, perhaps triggered by events we don't know about. One of the things which I find fascinating about Strike's character is that he is a very logical man, with good self-discipline, but when he gets emotional, his judgment can be well wide of the mark. So, with Talbot's notebook, the logical, puzzle-solving Strike would, by rights, be keen to assess the artifact on its own merits and decode it. But the Strike that reacts emotionally to certain triggers leans into his own bias and misses some pretty useful clues. It's not the only time in the book his bias and emotional reactions have consequences. His animosity towards his father leads to an almost catastrophic misjudgment and an altercation during an interview with a witness, Carl Oakden, which Strike can see with hindsight is an obvious setup. Of course, this particular flaw leads us into the sheer, gooey emotional joy of chapter 58, so this is not a complaint. But I think it's fair to say that Strike is slowly becoming aware of this tendency in himself.
So, fuck for that.
Stephen Schmidt wasn't the only person to have fiddled about with an already reasonably outlandish belief system, and the other significant esoteric tool in the book is tarot, specifically the Thoth tarot deck, created by a hugely significant figure in occult history, Aleister Crowley. Schmidt was a contemporary of Talbot, writing in the 70s, but Crowley's considerable impact started in the early 20th century. Always a controversial figure, Crowley very much forged his own path in Western esotericism and certainly didn't seek mass appeal. His views and beliefs were niche even among his occultist contemporaries, though he was and remains influential. Interestingly enough for our purposes in examining the Strike novels, he was born in Leamington Spa, the scene of Robin's triumphant interview with the artist Paul Satchwell. The tarot deck he created is something of an anomaly. These days, you can buy tarot and oracle decks in a dizzying array of designs and configurations. But most tarot decks are based on the Rider-Waite or Marseille tarot designs. With 22 major arcana or trump cards based on symbolic archetypes, and 4 numbered suits of swords, cups, wands and coins or pentacles, with court cards for each suit: king, queen, knight and page. Crowley's deck, the Thoth Tarot, is as idiosyncratic in setup as Schmidt's astrology is, in comparison to the more mainstream variety. The major arcana cards have different names and numbers, and his court cards are knight, queen, prince and princess. Given that he also attached lots of different esoteric meanings to each suit and each card in that suit, including lots of astrological references, you wouldn't need to be an expert to figure out that interpreting any reading from the cards would be at least as difficult as trying to decode the astrology in Talbot's notebook. A brief word on pronunciation here. Thoth is an ancient Egyptian word, and the pronunciation is far from clear. Given that you'll mostly only ever read it, this isn't a problem that will trouble most people. But obviously, if I'm recording a podcast, I've had to decide on a consistent choice, and I've gone with Thoth. But you might also come across Toth, Tote or Tot. I'm sure there are others. I rather wish he called it Jim, but there we are. Crowley never saw his deck become freely available, as he died in 1947, though there was a trial printing of a few of the cards from the deck in 1944. Llewellyn published the first commercial version in 1969, though there was a private print run in 1963. What I find especially fascinating about this aspect of the book is that in 1974, when Talbot would have come across the Thoth deck, and no doubt Schmidt's version of astrology, the UK was ripe with a fascination with the occult. There were documentary films and magazines and big screen movies that drew on the emerging new paganism, but one that was much less slick than the version you'll find easily today on Instagram. For all that, Crowley's deck would still have been an outlier compared to the more accessible Rider-Waite deck, and it seems entirely likely that Talbot made his choices of esoterica simply with what he happened to be able to obtain, which, by chance, were two of the hardest, most obscure versions of these divination methods. Rowling does her research and is by no means ignorant of either the history or the specific aspects of the methods she has chosen to include in her work, which I think indicates that these are quite deliberate choices. In keeping with that theme of chance that ripples through Troubled Blood, and arguably the earlier books to a certain extent. What was it but serendipitous chance that led Robin up the stairs in Denmark Street on that exact morning in 2010? A really good example of the questions the book poses about chance and coincidence is when Strike happens upon the child of people intimately connected to the very case he is investigating. I didn't do very well in working out the details of the case myself on a first reading of Troubled Blood, but one thing I did pick up on was the first mention of Samhain, wandering along in his Sonic the Hedgehog sweatshirt, appearing just before Strike speaks to Irene Hickson a second time and gets a physical description of the distinctive big-eared child that would be a man by now, and who then just happens to wander past the window on his way back in the other direction. In another book, that kind of coincidence would jar absurdly, but I maintain that in the context of a book that is examining chance as a theme, we're being asked some very interesting questions about the nature of coincidence and chance and the interplay of the subconscious. Remember that Strike and Robin have been rolling the facts of the case around for some time. Strike is in the exact area of the murder, pondering the details of the case, when he sees Samhain walking past. Yes, it's a chance sighting, but it's also not beyond plausibility, and the fact that the details of the case are simmering in Strike's brain mean that he is particularly alert to such details. The book doesn't force us into a conclusion, of course. It could be that Strike has simply benefited from random coincidence, but it might equally be something more like fate.
Lucky you.
We've already touched on Strike's sceptical bias against esoterica and spirituality, something we see again when it comes to Una, the purple-haired vicar. But it's not his only bias, and it's not even the only bias that affects the case. Final spoiler warning for revealing the killer here, so don't say I didn't let you know. Strike and Robin have a blind spot. Well, Strike and Robin have a few blind spots, but more of that shortly. In this instance, I mean very specifically about the case. It's a cleverly realised self-deception because Rowling manages to use the reader's blind spots in this regard too. When confronted with the killer, all our attention is directed to the woman we do not warm to, Irene, because she's overbearing and annoying, and because our heroes don't warm to her either. We think pleasant, innocuous thoughts about the friendly, nice, self-effacing nurse, Janice, largely because Strike and Robin do too. Our bias towards the detectives is used against us. Janice performs her compliant, acquiescent femininity perfectly, to the point that Strike is thoroughly tricked by her for some time, and he acknowledges towards the close of the book that he let himself be foxed by his socialised assumptions about women and nurses. There's a somewhat delicious sense of contrast between Strike's blistering showdown with the pompous, overconfident cruelty of the male serial killer Creed, which is truly a punch-the-air-in-triumph moment, in my opinion, and his final, quiet conversation with the female serial killer Janice, where her cosy mumsiness is belied by the chilling menace that reveals her sociopathy. Of course, regular listeners to this podcast will know that I am not at all on the fence about the romantic aspects of the books, and Troubled Blood also touches on Strike and Robin's particular biases about love. Robin is going through a divorce, which her lawyer says is the most drawn-out and acrimonious one she has experienced where there were no children involved. We, as readers, are already primed to expect the worst from Matthew, whom most of us have already pegged as a wrong'un a few books back. But Troubled Blood plays with us here. Just when we are wondering what further nastiness he might inflict on Robin, he suddenly does an about-face and settles quickly, leaving Robin, and to a certain extent the reader, reeling, having been expecting more difficulty. This is classic Rowling, of course, giving us a character decision that makes Matt simply a weak and foolish man, rather than a pantomime villain, and enables Robin to move on. Strike is still labouring under his heavy bias against romantic love, having had his heart cauterised by the controlling abuses of his ex Charlotte, who pushes the envelope as far as possible in this book, forcing Strike into a remote rescue and tormenting him with messages and an inappropriate picture throughout the book until he decides he will finally draw a red line and change his number so she can no longer do it. Arguably, Strikes is a slightly bigger emotional journey in Trouble Blood. Robin is dealing with big things too, of course, but Strike's painful path through his Aunt Joan's illness and death and the complications of his relationship with his father and siblings lead him to go from the cool, detached reserve of the opening chapter to what looks very much like a fresh optimism about love in the last. His relationship with Joan is deeply moving, as the pair move from social nicety and habitual surface-level communication into the kind of loving honesty that all too often, sadly, only happens at the extreme end of life. For Strike, I think it's a pivotal point, forcing him to address all sorts of assumptions he had about his family life, and indeed what he thought love was. Of course, the trajectory of his feelings with Charlotte also bring this into sharp relief, and the events of chapters 58 and 73 give us the biggest leaps forward in Strike and Robin's relationship yet.
Has someone gone to a lot of effort to get inside my head?
One of the neat conceits of the book is the way Rowling uses the esoterica. Now, you may have an opinion about the nature of tarot, be it mystical divination tool, Jungian psychology, or just a bunch of silly woo nonsense. But the rather distinctive thing about using it in a work of fiction is that the author has the ability to control the outcome. While in the real world, tarot may well be a meaningless game of chance with no hidden meaning or bearing on our life's events, in a work of fiction, where an author is essentially a godlike being, a tarot spread can have all the plot significance in the world. There's some suggestion that Rowling drew up the astrological natal charts for both Strike and Robin, and from a writing perspective, it's certainly one neat and efficient way of using random character traits in creating fictional characters. She's at liberty to take or leave whatever she wants in the results, of course. Tarot, however, is a slightly different animal. It's not based on a fixed point in time. It's very much pure chance when you randomly draw cards, as Robin does in the book. But not if you're the author. And I submit that Rowling knew exactly what she was doing when she had Robin draw three specific cards in Leamington Spa and three more in her bedroom at the close of the book. So I'm going to look at those readings, how they're presented in the book, how I believe Robin's misinterpretation misdirects and casts ambiguity over the meaning, and what the specific cards may be telling us about what the future holds for Strike and Robin. As I mentioned earlier, the card deck used in the book is Crowley's Thoth deck. It's a deck rich in symbolism, and while many of the cards correspond with the Rider-Waite version of the tarot in their meanings, the Thoth versions do have elements that add very, very interesting aspects to any possible interpretation for our two detectives.
How's that?
Not bad.
We'll begin with the first reading in Leamington Spa, where Robin has gone to interview Paul Satchwell. It's the night before she does so, and Robin has spent quite some time thinking about her feelings for Strike. It's something she's trying to be objective about. She's thinking about how he makes her feel in a positive sense, but she does also try to bring up the things about him which annoy her. She doesn't succeed in that focus, and ends up almost admitting she wants him to view her as a desirable woman. Then a phone call with him somewhat dampens her enthusiasm, and so we come to the moment where she decides to ask the tarot cards for them. She employs a three-card spread, which she understands as the first card referencing the problem, the second referencing the cause, and the third pointing to the solution. Given what she has just been consuming her time with, I think it's reasonable to assume that whatever these cards reveal doesn't have to have anything to do with her ostensibly trying to see her way through the investigation. That's important because, if you remember, we've already seen how the interplay of the subconscious and coincidence can give shape to the story. When she draws the Prince of Cups, which is the Knight of Cups in other tarot decks, and her first thought is of Dennis Creed, I think she's wrong. I think the problem presented in the first card is the man she's just been preoccupied with, the man she's in love with, Cormoran Strike. The description in the Book of Thoth that she reads from is that of subtlety, secret violence and craft, intensely secret, an artist in all his ways. Presumably it's the word violence that has sent Robin down the thought that this might mean the serial killer, but I think she massively misreads what the card signifies. The suit of cups is symbolised by water, and more than that, it tends to govern the sphere of emotions. The prince, or knight of cups, is an archetype of extremes of emotion, but there's a lot more going on. The card signifies someone who could possess chameleon-like qualities, an ability to fit in many different situations. You could read that as Creed, but it works for Strike too, the man with a nomadic childhood who learned to fit wherever he found himself. There's a strong sense with this card of someone who conceals and is careful with their strong emotions, someone with an instinct for sacrifice and dedication, and for whom there needs to be a bridge between reason and emotion. Sound like anyone we know? But tarot cards don't necessarily have to only symbolise a specific person. Given that this card is the problem, we could easily apply it to Robin's concerns about her feelings for Strike, being an illusion, a desire for emotional rescue, or perhaps just exaggerated. However, it's worth noting that when the Prince or Knight of Cups turns up in a layout, it's seen as an indication that the querent, that is, the person asking the cards a question, isn't being honest about their feelings. That being said, the second card gives us the cause. The Four of Cups is interesting for the card itself and Robin's reaction to it. She instinctively knows the card is referring to her, rather amusingly guessing the cards are criticising her for soft living. This makes no sense if the first card is meant to refer to Creed. Robin is not the cause of Creed being a problem. But she may well be the cause of her emotions around Strike being a problem. In actuality, the Four of Cups is, on a surface level, a very well-balanced card. The Thoth illustration shows four cups set in a square formation and all looks harmonious. But it's a card that doesn't go anywhere. It's a static image, complete and in and of itself. It might be safe and secure, but it's also stagnant and stalled. In the Rider-Waite deck, this card sees a figure being offered a fourth cup and not taking it, maybe not even seeing it. It's a comfort zone card. One writer, talking about a possible interpretation of the Thoth Four of Cups, says this: "The wish for stable feelings, love without risk and emotional security, leads us to live in mediocrity rather than intensive feelings. Here, a home, despite all its security, has somehow become small." The solution card presented is the Two of Cups. As I mentioned, the cup suit is related to the sphere of emotions, and the fact that all three cards in the spread are cups is a big indication of the overarching message. The fact that this card is the solution in both the readings should make your ears prick up for two reasons. One is that repetition is a very basic writing method to highlight something of significance. The other is that the Two of Cups is one of the most romantic cards in the entire deck. An author who wasn't familiar with the tarot might have chosen the more obvious major arcana card, the Lovers. But that card is talking about the balance of male and female on a rather bigger scale and can indicate negative temptation as much as romance. The Two of Cups is certainly talking about harmony between two people, but it's very much more attached to the idea of a specific love attachment. It's a very positive card indeed, stressing respect, and while harmonious, the two figures retain their separateness. It's a card that rejects codependency, which is a really significant thing given the previous relationships Strike and Robin have had. So, how would I sum up this first reading for Robin? Well, her problem is that she has feelings for a man who conceals his own, meaning she is nervous about revealing herself. The cause of this is that she has found a place of safety in Strike, and she's afraid to push out of that comfort zone. But of course, the cause will have the seed of the solution in it, which tells us that she needs to be the one to act and embrace the healthy, balanced, romantic relationship that is possible between them. At this stage in the book, it's a tentative nudge. When we get to the second reading, the message has shifted slightly.
What do you think?
Yeah.
Chapter 73 is a delight. We've walked with Strike and Robin through a difficult year, and we've seen them grow tantalisingly close as they've solved one of their hardest cases yet. Here, on Robin's birthday, we have a chapter that is sheer, unadulterated shippery. If you dispute the romance aspects of the Strike books, I don't know what you make of the last chapter of Troubled Blood. Robin again pulls out her tarot deck and draws three cards. Now, her method has been three cards based on the problem, the cause, and the solution. She only remembers this after she pulls the first card, the Two of Swords, which she reads as peace, and makes another little bias mistake. She decides to dismiss her method because she ascertains that peace isn't a problem. But Robin has it wrong. The suit she's pulled here, Swords, governs rationality and reason, and there is truly a double-edged meaning to many of the cards. So while the two perfectly balanced swords may indicate peace, what we have here is another card like the Four of Cups, a message indicating something stalled that needs to move forward. Peace is without motion, but that's not always good. What's telling here is that she returns to her method again, just as she did in the first reading, with the second card, which is a major arcana card, Adjustment, which is also known as Justice in other decks. She knows that this card is very much for her, possibly indicated to her by it being a card that represents her star sign, Libra. The book tells us that this card represents the woman satisfied. Equilibrium stands apart from any individual prejudices. There's that bias theme peeping through again. She is therefore to be understood as assessing the virtue of every act and demanding exact and precise satisfaction. The Thoth design here is fascinating, and the symbolism is very heavy. The woman on the card is a priestess of the goddess Mat, standing in front of a vesica piscis, which is an archetypal feminine symbol, holding a sword, which is an archetypal male symbol. And again, there is a strong element of balancing things here. As I've mentioned, the solution card is again the Two of Cups. So what is this reading saying to Robin and to us? The problem now is not specifically her feelings about Strike. The problem now is her inaction. The cause is that she has been overthinking as she weighs up all the possibilities in the most exacting detail. But as before, the cause has the seed of the solution in it, and it's in acting upon what she has discerned that she'll reach the solution. One final note on the specifics of the Thoth illustrations. Adjustment shows a woman in priestly regalia wearing a uraeus on her forehead. A uraeus is a serpent, signifying sovereignty and authority. Regular listeners to the podcast may remember the relevance of snakes to Strike in relation to Robin, and how he views her with the same affectionate fascination as a snake he found as a child and desperately wanted to keep. In context, it's clear that the adjustment card here is meant to be Robin. Now, if we go back to the Prince of Cups, which I still maintain is referencing Strike, it's worth taking a closer look at that illustration. The card shows a man riding a chariot being pulled by an eagle. But the significant thing here is that he's holding a cup that he's transfixed by and from which emerges a serpent. It isn't an enormous stretch to connect a card with a woman represented by a serpent to another card where a man is focused on one. The cards here may well be telling Robin about Strike's feelings, and that they are very much towards her. Now, obviously, this is all subjective, and the tricky thing about divination, and indeed the thing that Strike highlights as part of his scepticism, is that you can bend things to make them fit. Perhaps Rowling is playing a giant trick on her readers' biases here. But without getting overexcited, my view is that Troubled Blood was Strike's big emotional journey towards accepting his feelings for Robin, and by the close of the book, he's come on in leaps and bounds, to the point where he's recalling the unlikely conversation with Polwarth about Mazenkov and Krupov, and let's remember, that conversation was about marriage. My prediction, based on these readings, is that the next book is going to be Robin's journey, out of her stalled emotional inertia. And while I'm sure it won't be straightforward or easy, the repeated appearance of the Two of Cups is a very good indication that good things are coming, if she can be brave. And if we know anything about Robin, it's that she's brave. Also, just saying, but the Prince or Knight of Cups can also indicate a proposal. Not that you need to be more eager to know what's going on at the Ritz or anything.
You offering me a piggyback?
I have waxed long here, and because there is so much in the book, I've only managed to dig into a limited amount of things this time round. I am going to dig into other aspects in other episodes. I hope you've enjoyed it, and that I've highlighted a few tidbits that make you a little less bamboozled by some of the more obscure aspects of the book. I've now covered, to a certain degree, each of the current books, so future podcasts will take a more topical approach. And if you want to keep up to date with what my plans are, you can find me on Twitter at Clara Strike. Thanks to my fellow Strike obsessives and Strelicott shippers for their support and interest in the podcast. And a shout out here for the work of the brilliant folk at strikefans.com in collating a list of all the Fairy Queen epigraphs in Troubled Blood with a brief guide to their meaning, which is a really interesting, if spoilerific, resource and well worth your time, so go and take a look. I'm off to the Ritz to surreptitiously hide behind a pillar and see if any detectives are getting a bit carried away with the romance of the occasion. Cheerio.
You wait.